Robinson mentioned Charlie Kirk was coming to UVU. They talked about why they didn't like him and the viewpoints that he had.
A suspect in the shooting of Charlie Kirk is now in custody.
We'll walk through what we know and what we don't this Friday, September 12th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, what does the future of global HIV/AIDS prevention look like as the U.S. reconsiders its role?
In the past 9 or 10 months, the lights have gone out.
Also, an update on Brightline West, the planned rail line between Southern California and Las Vegas.
It's the closest the U.S. has come to a true high-speed rail like the ones in Europe and Asia.
And we meet a Pokemon collector who trades cards the way some people trade stocks.
Probably the biggest thing that Pokemon has going for it as a product and as an investment is that it's for everyone.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. The suspect arrested and accused of killing conservative activist Charlie Kirk is expected to be charged with aggravated murder. As NPR's Franco Ordonez reports, President Trump says the person held responsible should be given the death penalty.
President Trump praised the collaboration between local law enforcement and federal officials. In an interview with Fox and Friends, Trump said, quote, "We got him."
Well, I hope he's going to be found guilty, I would imagine, and I hope he gets the death penalty. What he did, Charlie Kirk was the finest person. He didn't deserve this.
The arrest follows a widespread search that began soon after the conservative activist Charlie Kirk was shot while speaking at a college in Utah on Wednesday. Utah's governor said casings found along with a rifle had inscriptions that read, among other things, "Hey, fascist, catch." Officials believe the suspect acted alone, but the governor says the investigation continues. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, New York.
Republicans representing Tennessee and Washington have praised President Trump's plan to deploy the National Guard troops to Memphis, but Republicans closer to home, while supportive, are choosing their words more carefully. From member station WPLN, Mariana Bacalao reports.
U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn and Congressman John Rose thanked Trump. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee says he will be meeting with Trump to work out details. When asked about a possible deployment last month, Lee said that crime in Memphis was down 15% year over year.
We've made significant investments toward public safety in Memphis, $150 million in intervention grant funds and vast expansion of troopers there.
State senators who represent Memphis have pointed to statistics that show crime in the city is at a 25-year low. In a statement, Lee stressed that the National Guard will be working alongside local law enforcement and called Memphis a world-class American city. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacalao in Nashville.
Puerto Rican rapper and singer Bad Bunny says he's decided to skip touring 50 states specifically concerning about ICE. NPR's Anastasia Tiolkas has more.
In an interview with ID Magazine, Bad Bunny said he and his team were worried about ICE raids on concert venues within the United States. He said, quote, "ICE could be outside, and it's something that we were talking about and very concerned about." Instead, the artist who's topped the charts with the sounds of his native Puerto Rico did a 30-date residency in his hometown of San Juan. That ends this weekend. Then he's on to Central and South America, Asia, Australia, and Europe. Anastasia Tsoulikas, NPR News, New York.
And you're listening to NPR. More than 200 recent heat waves have been made worse by human-caused global warming and the activity of fossil fuel producers. NPR's Julia Simon reports on the findings of a major study out this week.
First, the scientists found that 213 heat waves were substantially more likely and intense because of climate change. But that wasn't all. The team from ETH Zurich University used a database of major fossil fuel producers and calculated how much their greenhouse gas emissions contributed to global warming. They found dozens of heat waves would be virtually impossible without the activity of big fossil fuel companies because of how high their emissions are. As states, cities, and countries sue oil companies for damages from climate disasters, climate researchers say studies attributing specific events to specific corporations could become important in litigation. ExxonMobil, BP, and Chevron did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Julia Simon, NPR News.
3,200 striking workers with Boeing in the St. Louis area have rejected the company's latest contract proposal, which will extend the strike at three Midwestern plants that began August 4th. The machinist union says the company did not meet worker demands when it came to financial and retirement issues. Wall Street closed the week with stocks mixed today. The Dow declined 273 points, finishing at 45,834. The S&P was down 3 points, closing at 6,584. The NASDAQ finished up 98 points, ending the week at 22,141. That's a record high. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy with patchy fog, lows 55 to 61 degrees.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This morning, President Trump went on Fox and Friends and announced an arrest had been made in the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Investigators in Utah identified a 22-year-old man, Tyler Robinson, and they say they believe he acted alone in killing Kirk. And the arrest follows a two-day manhunt in Utah where Kirk was killed while speaking at a public event on the campus of Utah Valley University in Orem. For the latest on the case, we're joined by NPR's Bobby Allen, one of our team who is in Orem. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Tell me a little bit more what we know about this suspect.
Yeah, Robinson is a Utah native from a small town in the southwest part of the state. He doesn't appear to have any criminal history. Public records show he is not...
Bobby, we lost you. I'm going to hold the air for a moment and see if we can get you back. I know you're out there in Orem trying to get all this good reporting for us. We'll see if we can get the connection back. All right, we'll move on to our next story and try to get back on the line.
If you've walked in front of the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue just about any time in the last 44 years, you've probably seen a small protest, a peace vigil, a tent enclosure surrounded by signs calling for nuclear disarmament and the end of global conflict. It has been staffed 24/7 since 1981 by volunteers through hurricanes, blizzards, and seven presidents as a condition of it being allowed to be there.
But it has also always had its share of people who don't like it, including Brian Glynn, a correspondent with the conservative TV network Real America's Voice. He brought it to President Trump's attention last week.
It is an eyesore.
Oh, I didn't know that. Take it down. Take it down today, right now.
About 36 hours after Trump's command to take it down, the main tarp that protects the structure from the elements was forcibly removed by federal police and National Park Service workers early Sunday morning.
I was here by myself, and then, what do you know, 10 large, strong men come and they tell me that they're going to remove this and then tore it down in a matter of 5 minutes.
Will Rosine, a 24-year-old volunteer, was there when police came to take down the structure's protective tarp.
I found out how strong and well-made the tent was when I jumped on top of it. I about bounced to the moon. And then they ordered me to get off of it. I said no, of course. And they ripped me off, put me in handcuffs.
Our producer, Jordan Marie Smith, spoke with Rosine this week right next to the vigil, which was still somewhat intact minus the tarp. Signs still read, "Love Trump's hate and end nuclear threat." Rosine, who just started volunteering at the protest this year, spoke about its importance.
The decisions that are being made in secret inside the White House that have an effect on millions or billions of people around the world, it's important that those decisions and the consequences of those decisions are reflected out on its lawn. And that's what this peace vigil is it's a reminder that decisions have consequences.
When asked for comment, White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers wrote, President Trump is committed to the public safety of D.C. residents and visitors, as well as the beautification of our nation's capital. Rogers went on, this tent was a hazard to those visiting the White House and the surrounding areas. Rosine noted that volunteers do not sleep in the tent. They have homes elsewhere. It is not a homeless encampment. And said no rats, no weapons were inside the enclosure, just protest materials. And Rosine had one more message for Trump.
Peace prevails, baby. Peace prevails. He can't kill peace.
For many workers, open enrollment season is approaching. It's the time when we sign up for healthcare benefits through our employers. And it is looking ugly. Healthcare costs are soaring, which means most of us are probably going to pay a lot more next year. NPR business correspondent Maria Aspen has been reporting on this. She joins us now. Hey there.
Hey there, Juana. I have to say, as someone who spent more than 2 hours on the phone today trying to correct a medical bill, I am ready to talk about this.
Okay, let's get into it. Maria, as you were just reminded, prices already so high. What are we looking at for next year?
Right. The United States has the most expensive health care in the developed world, and it's about to get even more expensive across the board, however you get health insurance. But for most working age Americans, about 150 million of us, that's through our employers, and the news is bad. According to a big new survey from Mercer, which is a benefits consultant, most employers say they're bracing for the biggest price hikes in 15 years.
Doesn't sound great. What does this mean for workers?
Well, a majority of employers told Mercer that they're effectively going to pass those price hikes along to their workers. That might mean higher deductions from your paycheck for premiums, or higher deductibles, or copays at the office, or to fill a prescription. Mercer estimates that employees will see their paycheck deductions rise 6 to 7% next year. I talked about this with Beth Umlin. She's Mercer's Director of Health and Benefits Research. And she pointed out that employers have been dealing with rising prices for years.
I think just something had to give. And so it was like, okay, we've held off for as long as we can, and now we need to make an adjustment.
So now they're adjusting.
You have an article on NPR.org about this today. The headline is this: healthcare costs are soaring. Blame insurers, drug companies, and your employer. Maria, how much should we blame our employers?
Well, the buck stops with them. Our employers effectively decide how much they're going to charge workers every year to stay healthy. Now, that said, employers are in a tough spot. They're basically passing on the price increases they're seeing from health insurance companies, drug companies, hospitals, and all the other for-profit businesses in our healthcare system. And prices are going up for a lot of reasons. I mean, drug companies, for example, have developed more effective cancer treatments and blockbuster weight loss drugs, but they're charging more for them. After the pandemic kept people away from the doctor for a while, more people are going back, but that's driving up demand and prices. And then there are the giant for-profit conglomerates that now run a lot of hospitals and health insurance companies. They control a large part of the healthcare ecosystem, and they have the power to set higher prices. So at the end of the day, employers are getting hit with these high prices and passing them along to their workers. I talked about this with Larry Levitt, the executive vice president for health policy at the research nonprofit KFF.
In general, for workers, it's kind of take it or leave it, and they really don't have much of a choice but to take it.
Well, Maria, is there anything that workers can do?
I mean, short of changing jobs to look for an employer with better benefits, not really. For better or for worse, Juana, employer-based health care effectively is the system we have in the United States. There are government-sponsored alternatives, of course, like the exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act. But under President Trump's administration, a related federal tax credit is going to expire at the end of the year, which is going to make those plans even more expensive next year. So for many of us, as Levitt said, we kind of just have to take it.
All right. NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and we have Bobby Allen back on the line from us from Orem, Utah, where, Bobby, we lost you right when you were starting to tell me a little bit about what we know about this suspect who has been identified and now arrested today. This is 22-year-old Tyler Robinson.
Yeah, he doesn't have a criminal history. Public records show that he doesn't seem to be affiliated with any political party. He was a really bright student in high school. He even earned a scholarship to attend Utah State University. That's just north of here in Logan. But he dropped out after one semester. The university says that was back in 2021. More recently, Mary Louise, Robinson's family noted that he's become more politically active, which is a really crucial point since authorities are calling Charlie Kirk's killing a political assassination.
How did they find him?
Well, last night, Utah Governor Spencer Cox and FBI Director Kash Patel released new video footage of Robinson jumping off a campus roof after Kirk was shot, and officials pleaded with the public to help identify and locate him. And soon after, authorities say a family member of Robinson's reached out to law enforcement. Robinson apparently confessed to shooting Kirk to this family member. At the press conference, Cox shared an anecdote from Robinson's family that suggests he had been thinking about Charlie Kirk's upcoming event at Utah Valley University well before the killing.
The family member referenced a recent incident in which Robinson came to dinner prior to September 10th, and in the conversation with another family member, Robinson mentioned Charlie Kirk was coming to UVU. They talked about why they didn't like him and the viewpoints that he had.
Now, they didn't specify which viewpoints, but investigators recovered unused bullet casings with phrasings engraved on them, including, quote, "Hey, fascist, catch."
Okay, so a number of details as we start to piece together what may have happened. Have we gotten any word yet, Bobby, about possible charges?
Well, Robinson is currently being held in a county jail here in Utah on suspicion of aggravated murder and gun charges. State and federal officials have vowed to seek the death penalty against Robinson, but so far, Mary Louise, we have yet to see any charges from state or federal authorities.
Bobby, we've got a minute left, but I do want to broaden this out because this, of course, has renewed debate about political violence in the country. Did officials there in Utah address that?
Yeah, you know, Governor Spencer Cox, when he was done describing how law enforcement found Robinson, he did something really remarkable. He took a step back and really reflected on the moment. He, like many right now, really worried that Kirk's death could chill speech and make people afraid to air their views in large public settings. Uh-huh. And Cox said, ending political violence needs to be a very high priority, no matter how heated or divided this country becomes.
We will never be able to solve all the other problems, including the violence problems that people are worried about, if we can't have a clash of ideas safely and securely. Even, especially those ideas with which you disagree.
He said this political moment can be full of rage, but that hard political conversation should never turn into an attack.
All right. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen on the campus of Utah Valley University in Orem, Utah. It's NPR News.
It's 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji, with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. Now for your daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, September 12th, in 1996, the black ash are, for the most part, all yellow. Black ash are an interesting tree. They grow in wet soils, heavy clay soils that are not exactly suitable to a lot of plants because they tend to hold a little too much water for most plants. Part of the year, the black ash may be sitting in water. And despite this tough environment that they grow in and grow well, they are among the last trees to leaf out in the spring and among the first trees to drop their leaves in the fall. The leaves begin to turn yellow, and before the end of September, there won't be a black ash anywhere in northern Minnesota with a leaf still on it. Once the leaves are down, look for the infected flowers. Oftentimes, the black ash will have these great dark clusters of flowers that show an infection, a fungal infection that causes the flower to abort.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters today. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The LA fires earlier this year left thousands of homeowners at a crossroads. Rebuild or move somewhere else? But a few people have been choosing a third option. LAist's Cato Hernandez has more.
When I first meet Altadena resident Evan Chambers, his new home is getting cut into pieces. His wife and their two kids lost their original house in the Eaton Fire, but now he's helping dismantle their new two-story 1911 Craftsman home. Contractors are taking apart the house piece by piece and storing it in preparation for its move from another part of LA County to the Chambers lot in Altadena. The house will need some work, but Chambers wants the challenge.
You know, the thought of moving a house, even a house that's like super beat up, it's like, oh yeah, bring it on.
He says their insurance payout wouldn't cover the full cost of a new place. And while it will cover only about half the cost of moving and renovating this home, he hopes it's going to be cheaper. Plus, working on it reminds him of working on his old house.
It felt good to me, and I loved living in it. I was, like, intimately acquainted with my house. You know, I knew every little nook and cranny and splinter on the wood floors.
That's why the Chambers are partnering with a historic house relocation project, an effort from an architecture firm called Omgivning. Morgan Sykes J. Bush is the firm's creative director. He's identified dozens of homes slated for demolition across the county and is pairing them with people whose houses burned down. Their goal is to bring houses with character back to the charred neighborhood.
We just started cold calling those property owners to see if they would allow us to relocate the house in lieu of them demolishing it and throwing it into a landfill.
The project works by arranging a deal to transfer ownership of just the materials before the home is torn down. You could pay a buck for that or tens of thousands of dollars. The new owners also pay for moving, reassembly, and any customizations they want, like fire safety upgrades.
We know this isn't a solution for everybody, but really the reason people should be doing this is because they want an old house.
Right now, it's not totally clear how much cheaper an option this is compared to building a new home. It can vary. One family expects to pay $700,000, all told, while another, $1 million. That's about the median cost to buy a single-family home in L.A. County. J. Bush says that's because the homes are in different sizes and are in different conditions. They're working to help homeowners get a better sense of the costs up front.
We're hoping that we can wrap all of those different variables up so that it can be more clear for every homeowner.
House moving is rare, but it's allowed under California Building Code. Inspectors check the structure to make sure it's safely moved, and a lot of permits are involved just to drive it on the streets. A handful of families have elected to do this, but only two have moved their houses so far. I tagged along to watch one of them.
Yeah, we're back here by the tool truck, going to do a little safety meeting.
That's Rick Ellison, who's the owner of Dinuba House Movers, one of the contractors helping transport the pieces. He told me by phone ahead of time what to expect.
You ever seen grass grow? That's about how exciting house moving is.
He says crews put up wooden frames and plywood walls to keep the pieces sturdy during the drive. Those get chained onto a flatbed truck. From afar, it looks like a mobile home. Then they drive across from one part of LA County to another overnight with a city escort. That home's new owner is Gwen Sakina. She says it's been a tough journey to get here, but she's excited.
It's a lot to handle in a few months, so yeah, it's a huge range of emotions.
The drivers pull onto her dirt lot right before sunrise. They put the pieces on an elevated platform where it'll sit as the home is put back together. Sakina and her partner should be able to move in a year from now. For NPR News, I'm Cato Hernandez in LA.
If you grew up in the late 90s or 2000s, or your kids did, this might have been a part of your daily soundtrack. Pokemon were everywhere then, on your TV, all over merchandise, and of course as trading cards. These days, the Pokemon universe is enormous. The first generation of 151 characters has expanded to more than 1,000, and now for some people, Pokemon cards, they're a serious financial investment. Justin Wilson is one of them, an avid Pokemon card collector based in Oklahoma City. He recently spoke with the Wall Street Journal about the spike in the value of Pokemon cards, and he joins us now. Hey, Justin.
Hey, Ioana. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. All right, let's take it way back. When did you first start collecting Pokemon cards?
Yeah, so I started out in the late 90s whenever the trading cards came out. I was big into the cards. I was big into the video games, specifically started with Pokemon Yellow on Game Boy Color. Was also a big fan of the TV show and the movies as well. So, dipped into a little bit of everything.
What was it that got you back into it? Or was there a moment that you kind of realized that these cards could really be valuable?
Yeah, so I got back into it in 2019. So I had graduated college in 2016. I had started getting some disposable income. And I started just recollecting some of the same cards that I had as a kid. From there, I started collecting sealed boxes. And after 2020, whenever COVID hit, everyone was staying home. Everyone was going through their old card binders. And around that time, I started noticing the rise in interest in Pokemon again. And along with it came the rise in prices. Specifically, the prices of my sealed packs started growing at a really fast rate, and it really struck me that this might be something there.
That's so interesting. I have to ask at this point, how much is your collection worth? Do you know?
Yeah, so the current market value puts it right around $100,000.
That is a lot of money for Pokemon cards.
It sure is.
All right, let me ask you this. Let's dig a little deeper. How much is your most expensive card worth, and what is it?
Yeah, so I've got a first edition base set Holo Charizard. It is graded a PSA 7, and it is going currently for about $13,000 to $14,000.
For the uninitiated, what makes that card so special?
Well, so the original base set was the first set that came out in English back in 1999, and specifically the first edition of that. The first edition was much more limited, so that inherently increases the value of those cards. There's a lot lower supply of those. And the first edition Charizard really just was the card that everybody wanted.
So, Justin, what would you say to people, perhaps like me, who have a collection stashed somewhere collecting dust that they haven't looked at for years? What is the first step that they should take if they want to assess its value?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I would recommend is going on to eBay, and what you can do is you can search for whatever cards you have, whatever sealed packs you may have. Search for them on eBay. You can click the tab that specifically shows the sold listings. So at that point, you'll be able to see what your cards are selling for on a daily basis.
What has Pokemon meant to you over the years? Is this for you more about nostalgia, or is there something beyond that that makes this so meaningful for you?
You know, I think it really does boil down to just nostalgia and fun. You know, it really is just a fun thing to participate in. It's fun to collect. You know, they're releasing new sets every couple months of these trading cards that have beautiful artwork of these classic characters. So I think probably the biggest thing that Pokemon has going for it as a product and as an investment is that it's for everyone. Pokemon transcends language. It transcends borders, age, class, profession. It really is something that is for everyone.
We have been speaking with Pokemon card collector Justin Wilson. Justin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is National Native News. Support for KAXE comes from Itasca County Health and Human Services, hosting the 17th annual Community Connect on Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. And we receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. And don't forget our question of the week. We are looking for your favorite TV shows as we head into fall. Text 218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We recently talked to clients of the Northern Arapaho Reentry Program, which is helping people return home from out-of-state federal prisons and state incarceration to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, the reservation's home to the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes. Many clients in the program say they're more confident now to stay out of incarceration with the program's assistance. Today, we'll hear from partners of the reentry program. Terry Smith, the program's administrator, is a former Northern Arapaho tribal attorney and judge who says she connects with her clients on a deeper level after she went through a public downfall a few years ago due to drugs. This day, she's picking up clients and driving them to appointments. She helps people with transportation find jobs and find benefits.
I feel like this is just like perfect for me. Like I've been in their position, right?
I just want them to know that what they did and who they were before isn't who they have to be now. Our goal is for them to be self-sufficient so they can live a healthy life for themselves and their kids.
The reentry program works with other organizations like Eagles Hope, located in the town of Riverton, offering two-year sober transitional living. The facility is a former motel with 18 rooms with plans to expand. Devin Anderson is executive director of Eagles Hope.
A lot of landlords don't want to deal with felons. We have been working closely with Terry on housing her people. We have one guy here that is just, he's a really fine example of what someone can do for themselves. He came here, he has a lot of medical issues. Terry helped him with his rental fees, a lot of driving him around. We're all really confident that he will be able to work again and have a normal life.
Shannon McCorley is Eagles Hope administrative assistant.
I would say about 70% of the people we serve are enrolled either in Northern Arapaho or Eastern Shoshone. And I think it's because of lack of resources out there. So a lot of them want to come to town where there's more employment and more stuff to do, basically. It's awesome to see a lot of people that have gotten their kids back and have been able to find permanent housing, employment, vehicles, and seeing them out in the community. So at any time, I would say we have a waiting list of about 75 people.
Tremaine Thunder is a Northern Arapaho reentry client and was able to stay at Eagles Hope.
Things happened in my body. I got in a bad car accident, you know, and it broke me, really. Literally, it broke me, you know.
Thunder says the assistance he's received, especially from Terry Smith, has been a lifeline. Due to his bad heart and his medical condition, it was challenging finding services.
This is a blessing for our people, and I'm glad this reentry is here, you know.
The Northern Arapaho Reentry Program also works with the Doyanatsu Healing Center. Kelly Webb is the executive director of the Health Center, which is the culturally based substance use and behavioral health program for the Eastern Shoshone tribe.
Everything we do here is culturally based. So even when we're talking about brain science or other Western kinds of models, we put it back into the Shoshone medicine wheel and talk about it holistically. So we do a lot of holistic health services. We also have an office in Riverton, and that's how we have collaboration with Terry.
Here again is Northern Arapaho Reentry Program Administrator Terry Smith.
I want my clients to get a healthy life back. If they didn't have it before, to get it now. As long as they have hope and they work hard and they're accountable for what they've done, like they can have a beautiful life.
This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. Skugdash.
For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Dom Nye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. HIV has been in retreat around the world. Fewer people are dying of the disease. New infections are decreasing. More HIV-positive people have access to life-saving medicine. Those trend lines have been moving in the right direction for decades, and U.S. investment is one big reason. It's less clear where the trend lines go from here. While the Trump administration dismantled foreign assistance through USAID, it continued PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. But much of that work is either no longer happening or happening at a very reduced capacity. And last week, the U.S. said it will invest in a new drug that can prevent HIV with just 2 injections a year. So to understand where things stand and where they are going, Emily Bass is here. She's author of To End a Plague, America's Fight to Defeat AIDS in Africa. Welcome.
Hi.
Okay, if you could draw a chart showing the trend line since the 90s on HIV transmission and treatment, where do things stand right now and where do they need to get to eradicate HIV?
Well, let's talk about where they stood in December of 2024, Ari,
sure.
Because that's what we can really talk about with confidence, as I'll explain in a little bit. But in December 2024, on the brink of the new year, the year we're currently in, we were looking in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, which is where PEPFAR has focused its investments, at countries being on the path towards or having achieved a set of milestones that were associated with ending HIV as a public health threat
Wow.
by 2030.
So like the finish line in sight.
Yes, very much so.
So we've seen people fired and rehired. We've seen grants frozen and unfrozen. Can you say right now what the U.S. role in global AIDS prevention is and will continue to be, or is it all just totally murky and uncertain?
In the past 9 or 10 months, the lights have gone out. We don't know what has happened in the countries where PEPFAR has been supporting programs. We simply don't know. The data that would normally have been made available on a quarterly basis have not been made available. It's very difficult to get a clear picture. All of the reports from the ground tell the same story of massive disruptions, particularly in the service delivery approaches. So the ecosystem within which HIV services are delivered is not just the clinic and is there a drug on the shelf. It's how does a person get to the clinic? Are they greeted there by somebody who is friendly and not judgmental? Are the drugs delivered to their community? Is there a peer, someone with their lived experience who can help them understand the importance of accessing prevention or treatment and who will follow up with them if they stop accessing?
Okay, so even if the program still exists, its infrastructure has been partially or largely dismantled. The data is in some cases non-existent. And then you have this announcement that the United States is going to support this new HIV prevention drug, lenacapavir, which the medical community calls a breakthrough and a game changer. Is that enough to keep the trend lines moving in the right direction?
So absolutely not. It's good news. There's a couple things about that. It's good news. It is affirmation of a commitment that was actually made in the Biden administration. And it's only a piece of what we could have expected PEPFAR if we were speaking a year ago, to be doing to create an environment where a drug like lenacapavir could be part of a truly game-changing approach to HIV. And I just want to say, when you say the infrastructure isn't there, I think it's really important to be clear. The infrastructure is human beings. It's the community, it's the clinic staff, it's the clinic buildings. All of those things are there. PEPFAR did not have, you know, it's not like McDonald's. There aren't PEPFAR sort of branded buildings across sub-Saharan Africa. The infrastructure, the human beings and the clinics and the community connections are all still there, but the people who are being paid to support the ecosystem have lost their jobs or have been rehired temporarily. And the clinics are still there, but they're overcrowded and people are now waiting 10 or 12 hours a day to get their drugs or to be told that the nurses are done and they're going home.
To continue this conversation about lenacapavir, the U.S. says it plans to focus the rollout of this new medication on pregnant and breastfeeding women. They say in plans released last week that they plan to do it without NGOs, without nonprofit organizations. Is that possible?
Well, there's two things there, right? So let's take them one by one. Prior to 2025, PEPFAR was an evidence-based, evidence-driven, data-driven program that invested its resources in the most impacted communities and the communities where there was the most need for HIV prevention and treatment. Pregnant and breastfeeding women absolutely need access to pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP, which is what we're talking about with this injectable. But there are many other communities in all of these countries who are not pregnant, who are not breastfeeding, who are at tremendous risk of HIV.
The Trump administration has been talking about transition plans and reducing global reliance on the U.S. Can other countries step in to fill the gap that the U.S. is leaving?
You know, transition planning was underway before all of these changes occurred. When we were talking about ending HIV as a public health threat as 2030, that was the horizon line for moving countries first towards control of their HIV epidemics and then to a maintenance phase where they would be able to increasingly manage that continuation of HIV in the community, in the country, but with their own resources and perhaps with additional overseas development aid, but in different ways or diminished levels. That's an off-ramp. What we did is take the car off the off-ramp, if you will, and just drive it into a wall, right? So sure, transition is possible. It's less possible now than it was at the end of 2024.
So where do you think the trend lines are going to go in the next few years?
I think the trend lines are already going in terrible directions, Ari. I think the trend lines are going in the direction of new HIV infections, including for infants and newborns. I know this from my own work. I was in Uganda and Tanzania in the first 100 days after the freeze, where drug supply was incredibly unstable in some contexts. And I spoke to clinic directors who had seen 25% of their pregnant women give birth to babies with HIV.
Which is preventable.
Which is preventable, and they had had none for years prior. So we're going to see new infections, but we're also going to see people with interruptions in their treatment. People with HIV that I've spoken to are skipping doses. They're hoarding their medication. They're seeing the news. They're anticipating a point where they won't have medications anymore. Or they can't wait 12 hours at a clinic. Or the community support that brought the drugs to their community is no longer there. And when people disengage from care, they get ill. And unfortunately, the way that the data blackout has happened, some of this is already happening and we can't tell the story of it yet.
Emily Bass is author of the book, To End a Plague, America's Fight to Defeat AIDS in Africa. And she's also co-author of a Physicians for Human Rights report this month on the impacts of the foreign aid transitions in Uganda and Tanzania. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate or share our work. Visit KAXE.org. Cross Lake Community Center hosts Family Fest Saturday, September 13th from 1 to 3 with a pet adoption event, giant inflatable slide, face painting, and more. Grand Rapids Farmers Market is hosting a local food demonstration Saturday, September 13th at 10 a.m. Learn how to make apple cabbage salad. There will be a limited number of free ingredient kits available. Walker Ethnic Fest is downtown Walker tomorrow with food and art from 10 to 5, parade at 11, and live music from noon to 9.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, Minnesota's Secretary of State fires back at Washington about what he says are false election claims. Then, an iconic concert comes to the North Star State for the first time in 40 years. And a fashion designer from Duluth is heading to the nation's biggest stage. I'm Gracie J. Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon pushed back on President Trump's claims about elections. Simon called the president's social media post from earlier this month, quote, alarming, and warned that it spreads conspiracy theories. He said the Constitution gives states, not the president, full control of elections. Simon says Minnesota ballots are always cast on paper, counted with certified tabulators, and verified for accuracy. He also defended voting by mail as a secure bipartisan option used by more than 1.2 million Minnesotans last year. Simon promised to fight in court if Trump tries to seize state election authority. In today's main story, for the first time in its 40-year history, Farm Aid is bringing its music festival to Minnesota. McFinnigan talks to the organization behind the iconic concert about why they chose our state.
Live for Farm Aid at a concert for America. Here's Willie Nelson!
That was September of 1985 for Farm Aid's first music festival to support family farmers. Now, 40 years later, for the first time ever, Farm Aid is coming to Minnesota. Co-executive director Jennifer Fahey says it's been a goal of theirs to bring the music festival here.
Because of the rich history here in the farm movement, agriculture in general, many of our partner groups are here who have been our partners since 1985.
One of those longtime partners is IATP, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Ben Lillison, Director of Rural Strategies and Climate Change, has attended a handful of Farm Aid festivals over the years.
IATP was formed a little bit after Farm Aid actually started, but we've always been partners. And what Farm Aid does is put a spotlight on the situation for farmers at any particular time.
Ben reflected on the special performances he's seen, but emphasized that Farm Aid puts an incredible amount of effort to keep farm families on the land.
One of the things it does is shine a light on wherever the location is, what that food and farming system is like. And so it's really cool to be able to shine a light on what Minnesota is doing.
At the festival, they highlight local farming in the area called the Homegrown Village. Attendees can expect to learn about the state's diverse and resilient agriculture economy that makes Minnesota unique.
You have your corn and your soy and your hog producers and so forth. But we also have a lot of organic production, CSA production, people selling into local markets, to schools. We have our whole food co-op system, which is very unique.
Minnesota has long embraced the changing farm economy. Todd Western IV is an urban farmer in North Minneapolis. He has found success selling at farmers markets like the one in Richfield, where they can support food pantries like Veep, the Twin Cities' largest food shelf.
They're allowed to purchase the leftover produce, and they bring it to the local food shelf.
The senior and farmers market nutrition programs that allow markets to buy excess produce is on hold for the time being.
Yeah, I'd say right now it's just a lot of uncertainty on a number of fronts.
Jennifer from Farm Aid says uncertainty is hard for farmers, as farming is inherently uncertain and risky.
So we pay attention to those issues and see what can we lift up? What do eaters need to know that could help them support farmers?
Educating eaters or consumers is a big part of the festival's mission. Outside of the festival, Farm Aid works year-round to support family farmers through their Farmer Resource Hotline, breaking down farming news, and platforming the stories and struggles of farmers.
You know, we exist to support farmers when they need us, but also to just appreciate farmers and to bring people in to do that too, so we can support them every day and make them stronger.
The festival will take place at Huntington Bank Stadium on the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus on September 20th. There will be performances by the founders Willie Nelson, Neil Young, and John Mellencamp, along with a stellar lineup of other musician activists. More information on the festival at farmaid.org. This is Mick Finnegan with North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. A Duluth designer is bringing Minnesota style to New York Fashion Week. Leo Spry, who grew up in Bemidji, will debut his brand on the nation's biggest fashion stage with pieces like loon camouflage pants inspired by his roots. Northern News Now TV in Duluth reports that Spry began designing during the pandemic after receiving a sewing machine in college and has since built his label, 037, selling online and collaborating with artists. He'll host a show in Minneapolis before heading to the Big Apple for Fashion Week.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The U.S. is one of the few wealthy countries in the world without a true high-speed train. Brightline West is betting it can change that. The company officially broke ground last year on a high-speed rail line between Las Vegas and Southern California. But as NPR's Joel Rose reports, it's had to make some big compromises to get this far.
Brightline West is planning to build a terminal in Southern California, but it is not in Los Angeles, where you might expect. It's about 40 miles east of downtown LA in the city of Rancho Cucamonga.
We've got the best name, so who doesn't want to say Rancho Cucamonga, right?
Elissa Cox is the assistant city manager for Rancho Cucamonga, a city of about 170,000 in Southern California's Inland Empire. We met at the Metrolink station, where regional rail trains connect with LA. This is where Brightline plans to build a terminal that will handle millions of travelers a year. Cox says the city is doing its best to plan for that.
There is nowhere else in the United States that has high-speed rail, that'll have the Metrolink. There is nothing like it yet, so there isn't necessarily another city to call up and say, like, hey, how did you deal with XYZ?
Brightline West wants to be the first true high-speed line in the U.S., with a top speed of about 200 miles per hour, faster than any Acela train on the Northeast Corridor or Brightline's current service in Florida. The project also aims to ease the notorious congestion between L.A. and Las Vegas. Even the Trump administration, which has tried to strip federal funding from another high-speed rail project in California, is on board with Brightline West so far. Here's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy last month.
I would love to see high-speed rail in America. I don't think it should just be China, Europe, Japan, others that have high-speed rail.
Still, high-speed rail is expensive. Brightline West is expected to cost at least $12 billion and likely more. The company has raised about half that amount from private financing and federal grants. But it's warning investors that construction costs are rising, and skeptics worry about whether it can deliver on its promises.
I think that there's a lot of risk around it failing, and I wouldn't have said that a year ago.
Mark Jaffe is with the California Policy Center, a conservative-leaning think tank. Jaffe says investors have some doubts about the project, and he believes they are right to be concerned.
I think it'll be late. I think it will generate less revenue than they expect. Between those two things, I don't think it'll be successful, at least from a financial point of view.
Brightline West declined an interview request for this story, but Asha Jones, the vice president of corporate affairs, laid out some of the company's plans in a virtual presentation for the San Bernardino County Transportation Authority in June. Jones said the link between Brightline West and the LA regional rail system will be seamless.
You'll be able to buy one ticket that will take you from Las Vegas or any of the other pickups into, if you're going to LA or wherever you're going that Metrolink goes. We want it to be quick and efficient.
Building a terminal in Rancho Cucamonga instead of LA should save time and money. And the company has made other moves to keep costs down. For most of the route, it plans to build in the median of an interstate highway so that it doesn't have to acquire as much land. But those compromises come with downsides. The decision to build a single track in the middle of the freeway will limit speeds and cap the number of trains. Still, high-speed rail supporters see Brightline West as the best chance to get a train up and running in the U.S.
Yes! Give it up for Brightline!
At the groundbreaking in Las Vegas last year, then-Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg helped drive in one of the ceremonial spikes.
I am firmly convinced that once the first customer buys that first ticket to ride true high-speed rail on American soil, there will be no going back.
That's the bet Brightline West is making, and it's hoping investors like the odds, too. Joel Rose, NPR News, Rancho Cucamonga, California.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
Mariachi is growing in popularity in the United States. In the last decade, at least 10 colleges and universities have started offering degrees in the traditional Mexican folk music. The latest, Denver's Metro State University. Colorado Public Radio's Juanito Hurtado Huérfano reports.
Los Correcaminos, Metro State's Mariachi Ensemble, is practicing Mexico Lindo in a classroom on its Denver campus. Ruby Flores, who is playing guitarrón, joined the ensemble 2 years ago. She learned about them when she signed up for a mariachi class 2 years earlier. She was looking for a place to belong.
I grew up a no sabo kid,
meaning that she grew up in a Spanish-speaking household, but did not learn the language, something very common in first-generation kids. Her parents immigrated from Mexico.
Being in the United States, my mom really wanted me to be, you know, a United States citizen and, you know, kind of conform to their norms. So the mariachi class was where I tried to reconnect it, and then I instantly fell in love.
Professor Phil Fischer saw in students like Flores an opportunity to expand the program. Mariachi classes and ensembles are becoming more popular in Colorado K-12 schools. They need teachers, and Fischer students are eager to enter the industry.
I took a poll, kind of just a straw poll of my students, and every single hand went up.
He was trying to recruit a student from a city a couple of hours south of Denver.
When I said, hey, we're starting a mariachi degree, his first thing was like, I'm there.
Metro State's degree, launched this year, is called a Bachelor of Arts in Mariachi Performance and Culture. It allows students to dive into the music's history and cultural impact and learn the skills to run their own mariachi businesses. Faculty say the degree will also allow them to charge more for gigs because it proves their experience. They can even earn a teaching certificate.
I want one of our students to graduate and have the ability to say, I want to create my own mariachi ensemble. How do I do that? How do I fill out the paperwork? How do I invoice? How do I do all the things that help a business run?
1, 2, 3. Professor Fischer takes a lot of pride in the business aspect of the mariachi degree. But he thinks using the program to elevate mariachi's history and cultural impact is what will make a great mariachi musician.
You know, Beethoven once said that music is poetry without words. And in a way, mariachi music is the poetry of the Chicano culture.
The degree is available to all incoming students this fall. For NPR News, I'm Juanito Hurtado Huérfano in Denver.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build skills and confidence through personalized math instruction to help students achieve their potential this school year. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit September 22nd and 23rd in Brainerd. This two-day event features keynotes, interactive workshops, live music, and a special film screening. Full details can be found at sewingroom.org. Mixed Precipitation Opera and Theater Group presents Pickup Truck Opera Volume 5 tomorrow at 3 p.m. at the Mask and Rose Theater in Popaski. Looking at weather tonight, mostly cloudy with patchy fog, lows 56 to 61 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs in the upper 70s, low 80s, evening lows in the upper 50s. And Sunday, highs in the upper 70s, mid 80s, partly sunny skies.